Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. This is the second part of our programme with Billy Bragg.
Levi Stubbs
Hello and welcome to Master Tapes. That's the sound of Billy Bragg playing Levi Stubbs Tears for our audience here at the BBC Maidavale Studios. In the first part of this edition, I talked to Billy about the making of his difficult third album, Talking with the Taxman About Poetry. We heard how, in 1986, the solo troubadour decided to expand his sound by bringing in guest musicians, how he responded in song to some of the political issues of the day, and why his love songs often sounded as angry as his protest songs. This is what we like to think of as the B-side of the programme. Now it's the turn of our studio audience to ask the questions, and we'll have some more live music from Billy. But we're starting with a question from Andy Huffer.
Which are easier for you to write, the political or the love songs, and do you have a preference?
Well, that's a complicated one because it suggests that you summon them up at will. I think what happens is an issue burns its way into your consciousness and you have to write about that issue. You realise that you've got something to say that you haven't heard reflected elsewhere, and you know there's something driving you to get in there and write it. I think both of them are precious, but they have different responses when you play them to an audience. The most recent political song I wrote was a song about the phone hacking scandal called Never By the Sun. The first time I sang it was the day after I wrote it, which was on the Saturday of the week that the news of the hacking of the murdered girl's phone broke. And when I sang it at that festival, the audience applauded every verse. And it wasn't because I'd written a great song. My sense of it was that they had the first opportunity to, as a community, express their outrage at what had happened. And my song had merely touched that nerve for them and allowed them to have that expression. Now, I might write a song that nails your relationship somehow in some weird kind of strange ways if I've been reading your mail. But if I have done that, your response is more likely to be stunned silence. So I like to evoke both those things. I like to play love songs that really touch people, and I like to write songs that make people feel I'm helping them to express something they feel angry about. And I love it both. I mean, people come up to me after the show and say to me, you know, you made me cry tonight. And I'm like, good, mate, because I've come a long way. And I want to get some emotional response from you of some sort. So I take that as a thumbs up. So, I don't pick and choose. They kind of pick and choose me.
And Andy was asking there about the difference between the political and the love songs. But just remind us of the political context of the time, because you'd recognise the power of the protest song as a Clash fan and then as a Bob Dylan fan and discovering Woody Guthrie. But being directly catalysed as a songwriter by events of the time, the miners' strike clearly, the Thatcher government of the day, but also the unfolding events in Eastern Europe, I presume, as well.
It was kind of worse than that. It was having grown up really admiring the great protest song writers and thinking of music as a means for changing the world. You know, I believed the Clash were going to change the world by making records. I did believe that. When my moment came and I suddenly found myself on the lip of this world-changing moment, which was the miners' strike, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to go and find out if you can change the world. It's me now. How do I approach this, you know? And I had early on in the strike, I had a shocking experience when I went up to somewhere up in Yorkshire with my electric guitar and my punk sensibility to tell them all about what was happening. And, And when I got there, there was this old geezer sitting down with his hand over his ear, singing unaccompanied. His name was Jock Purden. He's probably in his late 70s, singing these old songs. And he was so much more radical than I was. It was scary. I realised I was in a completely different tradition here and I needed to rethink what song did. You didn't come charging in with a banner and lead everybody to the barricades. It was a different role, and that's how I ended up seeing Jock Purden kind of led to Between the Wars and to There's Power in a Union. But it's the experience of it, actually living it, rather than writing about it in abstract, that made me write those more ideological songs.
Next question, and this is from Rob Beer.
So the album seems like it was a real step up in terms of production, with multi-layered songs like Greetings to the New Brunette. Did you feel any sense of pressure when working with session musicians, or were you just excited to hear your sound expand?
I was excited very much to hear my sound expand. And it's not quite so many session musicians as you might think. On Help Save the Youth of America, it's more or less all me. Even the rhythm is a rhythm stick, which is like a big broom pole with a load of bottle tops attached to it, and you thump it up and down like that and do that a few times. Obviously, I'm playing that great big, you know, riff. I'm playing that for all I'm worth on this very guitar. I think there might be a little bit of mandolin there, but still basically a solo record. But those days when we did have Johnny Marr in the studio, Kirsty McColl, Kenny Craddock, who played the keyboards on the record, and Simon Morton, who added a little bit of percussion here and there, they were always exciting days. And if you notice my record since then, I've always worked with a band. Because the experience of being in the studio with a band, I have found, makes me raise my game.
And Rob, let me throw it back to you. Which do you prefer, the stark, unadorned Billy Bragg records or those where he's got the band behind him?
It's like Dylan, when I first got into Billy Bragg, I really liked the rawness of it, and that's what I found appealing, but your tastes change.
You're too young to have been around at the time, aren't you? So when did you get into Billy Bragg?
I was probably 15 or 16, studying history and politics at college, so it was...
Part of the course.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's funny, most people who are 16 or 17 who clock me in the streets, you're Billy Bragg, aren't you? I say, yeah, I am, mate. And my teacher thinks you're great.
I mean, your audience has grown with you, and the people who come to the gigs, I presume many of them were there with you in the early 80s, but is there a young crowd as well?
Well, all I can say in terms of that is that when we do a gig that's all seated, we generally sell it out before the show. My audience know that I will stand on stage and talk and play for 2 hours and think nothing of it, so they want a nice comfy seat to be able to do that in, and I appreciate that.
But if this is a representative Billy Bragg audience, then you're doing pretty well.
I think what's happened is that, you know, people talk about how terrible the internet is for the music industry, but I think that for someone who doesn't get played much on mainstream radio and is not featured anymore in the New Musical Express, there is an element of what's going on online with people peer-to-peer recommendations, and in some cases perhaps even file sharing, that is helping to spread the word about me and what I do. And I think the music industry doesn't like to encourage that kind of idea, but I think there is an element of that personal recommendation that helps artists like me. I'm against piracy. I'm totally against that, but that's people selling my stuff and keeping the money and not giving me any. I want them people to be arrested and put through the process. But people sharing files saying, check out this old geezer, he's a bit political, I think that's cool.
OK, let's have another question. This is from Cat Cray.
You touched on this a little bit already, but is your songwriting different now because the current political landscape no longer has something like the miners' strike influencing it?
In the sense it's not as ideological as it was, yeah. The language of the left in the 1980s was basically the language of Marxism. And going into the miners' strike, when I turned up to do that gig with Jock Purden, I ended up sleeping on someone's sofa up there in Yorkshire, wherever it was, and they kept me up all night asking me questions about my politics because they wanted to know why this pop star from London was coming up. You know, was I just doing it for my career? Or could I actually walk the walk as well as talking the talk? And to be honest, at the start of the miners' strike, I couldn't really. I didn't really know a great deal about the language that the left used. So I kind of had to come to terms with that. But, you know, that ideological language didn't really make it out of the 20th century. Although the problems that Marx was trying to address have not been resolved, the language that we used to talk about it in the 20th century I don't think resonates much with people anymore. So I find myself talking, and I have been for a while now, in terms of socialism, I'm talking about socialism of the heart, I'm talking about compassion.
And yet the lyrics to the song Ideology still resonate today, don't they?
Yeah, they do, because, I mean, I felt that for some people ideology was getting in the way of dealing with things. You know, there was a whole debate in the early 80s about the Nicaraguan revolution, whether we should support it, whether it was a bourgeois revolution or whether it was a workers' revolution. It didn't matter. These people needed help. They needed medical supplies. They had the United States of America leaning heavily on them. They had a dictator they were fighting. I didn't see why we needed to be having an ideological distinction about what kind of revolution it was. So I've always been tripped up by dogmatists and ideologues. Still, it still happens to me.
And just while you're talking about that song Ideology there, can you just grab your guitar and give us a sense of how that song possibly would have started? How that first line, if it was the first line initially,
yeah, I mean,
suggests itself.
With Ideology, we're taking our riff from this rocking back and forth on the E. When one voice rules the nation, just because she... It used to be she's top of the pile. Now it's their top of the pile. So you see, I've just tweaked it a little bit there. Because they're top of the pile,
doesn't mean their vision is the clearest. And the voices of the people falling on deaf ears. Our politicians all become careerists.
I mean, you could play that any time, couldn't you, in the last 30 years, I guess.
Well, let me ask you a question about those careerist politicians. Mm. At this time, you aligned yourself to the careerist politicians, particularly Ken Livingstone and Neil Kinnock, because you formed Red Wedge, and this was bringing together musicians who were explicitly aligning themselves with the Labour Party. Now, looking back on that as a coalition of musicians and politicians and then taking that on the road, what does it feel like now when you think back to that?
I'm very proud of it. The way I saw it, you've got to remember the context for Red Wedge. You know, we were a bunch of musicians, people who kept meeting each other at benefit gigs during the miners' strike. And when the miners' strike ended, we had a choice. We could have just packed up our bags and guitars and gone back to playing on Top of the Pops with Kajagoogoo, the other great band of 1986. Or we could see if there was another opportunity to defeat the government of Margaret Thatcher. Now, there were people, those ideological people I was talking about earlier, who assured me that there would be a revolution. The miners' strike was a revolutionary opportunity. There was moments when it did seem like that, but that wasn't the outcome. So what next? And there are some people still who believe you can't do anything until you first overthrow capitalism. That's a big ask. We felt that the Tories could be defeated at the next election if there was a debate about the Labour Party. So we put our head in that particular lion's mouth.
And you don't regret that?
No, I don't regret it at all, because I think at the time I was trying to find out if pop and politics did mix. I was the person now who could find out how far this could go, how far, because, you know, I learned a lot from what The Clash did, but I also learned a lot from their mistakes. And one of their mistakes, I felt, was that they never engaged with mainstream politics, and I couldn't understand that, because that's where change happened. Mainstream politics had given me free healthcare, free education, decent, affordable housing, you know. So I thought that we must try and build on those connections we've made and see if we can push this forward. And I know that, you know, some of the participants, most notably Paul Weller now, regret doing it. And I respect that. I mean, I'll give Paul his due. He said at the time he felt that the politicians were using us. And I said to him at the time, yeah, but we're using them too, Paul. So long as the compromises we make are on our terms, and they were. I mean, we had our own manifesto that Kinnock signed off on. We weren't the Labour Party's idea. We were completely autonomous from the Labour Party. We're doing stuff on our terms. But I guess the problem for some artists was that they felt that their careers could be damaged by this. And so they were trying to size up. I mean, you know, it wasn't, even back then, the Labour Party weren't the fabulous, glamorous vehicle for change they are now.
Well, let's move it on. Let's get another perspective on Billy Bragg in the mid-80s and what was happening around the making of Talking with the Taxman about poetry. This is a question from Claire Murphy.
What would you say to the younger man who sang Here We Are in Our Summer Years, living on ice cream and chocolate kisses? And do you consider yourself in your autumn years now?
Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? Yeah.
And that's a quote from one of the
it
songs.
It is, I know exactly what it's from. It's from Greetings to the New Brunette. And fortunately, would the leaves fall from the trees if I was your old man and you were my missus? Implies in that a union, an emotional union, would stave off those autumn years. And that has been my experience. Juliet and I have been together for unbelievably 20 years now. And not only do I still feel connected to that young man, I still occasionally bring chocolate kisses home for me from the United States of America. So, yeah, it's not just all metaphor. Sometimes it's actually for real.
Let's get another... Sorry, I'm just going to catch up with where we are.
I know, I'm almost in tears myself. That's beautiful, isn't it?
This is a great question, the next one. I'm really intrigued by the answer. It's from Annalisa Jesperson.
How far do you think you get on X Factor?
How far would I get? Sister, if I'd have had to get past X Factor to do this job, I would still be working in a record shop in East Ham, or maybe driving a tank somewhere, I think, you know. My light shone not through the glitzy cauldron of tack that is the X Factor, but through the dark and mysterious, murky nighttime radio of John Peel. John Peel was my X Factor. You know, before Peel played my music and had me in for a session, I could only really get gigs by word of mouth for people that I knew. Once Peel had played my record, I could play anywhere that people heard John Peel, in Scotland, in Scandinavia, in Holland. The thing about Peel was he was the antithesis of the X Factor. He took on all comers. And you listen to his programme, half of it you wouldn't like. Of the other half, half of that, you'd think, no, I'm not going there. That's not for me. Although it is obviously interesting. Of that last little quarter, half of that, you'd think, oh, hello, I haven't heard that before. And then there will be, at the bottom, there'll be 10% who you either taped off the radio or you went out and bought the record. And I was very fortunate to have been part of that.
That was a platform, and people were listening to you, people who otherwise wouldn't have heard of Billy Bragg. If you were starting out now, and taking it back to the original question, would you apply for X Factor, do you think?
No, I wouldn't, no. Because I think X Factor is that part of the music industry that is purely about entertainment. And I recognise that entertainment is an important part of the music industry, and I hope to entertain with the songs that I sing and the things that I say. But I've always been more interested in content rather than style. My radio plugger was here earlier for the early part of the programme. He's had to go off to do some stuff with another band. To plug some other band. And, you know, when he gets my records and he brings them in and they won't play them on the radio, I always say to him, look, you know, man, listen, it's Billy Bragg, remember? It's not just some of a band, it's Billy Bragg. I come with baggage. You'll never see anyone sing one of my songs on X Factor. Too much baggage.
Next question from David Foster.
Hi, Billy. In 2006, Neil Young wrote his Living With War album saying that there was no new generation of singers interested in protesting the wars in the Middle East. Is your view of the modern protest movement, such as it is, as bleak as Mr. Young's, or are you more hopeful for the future of this musical tradition?
Well, that's two different things, isn't it? Young political movement and musical tradition. I am hopeful about the young political movement because I see it out there. I pick it up on the internet. I hear it on Twitter. I catch it on Facebook. Musical movement, I'm not so convinced by. I think the world has changed sufficiently that young people who want to engage in politics have a number of ways of doing that now. They can blog, you know, obviously they can use Twitter and Facebook, but, you know, for a relatively small amount of money, you can make an amazing video document of a struggle and put it on YouTube. When I was 19 years old during punk rock, the only medium available to me, if I wanted to talk about my anger about the world, if I wanted to engage with the world, was to pick up one of these things and write some songs, do some gigs, and try and get my voice heard. Now, that takes a long time. It's quite complicated, and many fall by the wayside. So I can understand why a younger generation might choose to engage in a different way. But you've got to understand that my generation were, not only were we heavily involved in the miners' strike, which was a year-long class struggle, the like that you don't really see much these days, but we were also primed for it by punk rock. Those of us who were born in the late 50s were the last generation who had to fight tooth and nail for our culture to get on the radio. We didn't grow up with ubiquitous pop music wall-to-wall on the telly all the time and everywhere. So I'm so old as I remember what alternative music is supposed to be the alternative to. And having said that, you know, you can't expect another generation just to pick up on these things, particularly if you're waiting for young people with guitars. I think there are people who are trying to make some sense of the world, and some of them are using acoustic guitars, but I'm not expecting that to be the spearhead.
Throughout this programme, Billy, we're asking you to take yourself back to the mid-80s and to make those comparisons. When you think about those songs that were written then, are you writing in exactly the same way now, or have you learnt over the years a different style? How different is it now to then?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of types of Billy Bragg. There's a classic Billy Bragg, which we refer to as sort of chop and clang, which is a kind of... But it's also a more gentle sort of singer-songwriter, Billy Bragg, that approaches things in a little bit more of a... See, both those Billy Braggs have always been there. And sometimes one comes to the fore. Now, the last record that I made for my own website was all political songs called Fight Songs. You know, I've got another record to make next year, and I think it's about time I sort of wrote some love songs to balance that up.
But is there always a song, a melody, a lyric bubbling around in your head?
All the time,
What's happening right now in your head?
What's happening right now in my
head?
We want
to hear the next Billy Bragg song.
We want to hear the next Billy Bragg song. It'll be something like... that I was goofing around the other day. I mean, you always got things...
And there are words to go with that?
Not yet, no. Not even a melody.
Right.
But you kind of woodpile these things. You know, the great thing now is you can just sort of sing them into your phone. You can chuck them on your computer. You know, I mean, a lot of my ideas are on my computer as phone messages, and it's really annoying because my son does it as well. So there's his phone messages and my phone messages, and I have to listen to them and work out if it's me or him playing. But I don't want to be nicking his songs, and I don't want him being nicking my songs.
Does he sound like you?
No, he doesn't sound like me, no.
But there's always a stockpile of melodies, of chords, and then of lyrics, and it's a matter of matching words to music at some point, then, is it?
It's a bit more complicated than that. lyrics are a little bit more difficult. They're much harder than picking up tunes. I can pick tunes out of the air, generally. You know, if you tell me what sort of tune you want, I can usually find one. But lyrics, saying exactly what you want to say, that's cutting into the stone. Once you do that, it all becomes a bit more real.
But in the first edition of this programme, you suggested that that line in Greetings to the New Brunette, the line about how can you lie back and think about England when you don't even know who's in the team, could have been the building block for the whole song. So is there any great line going around your head at the moment you think will at some point work its way into a song?
The only thing I can really say to illustrate that is that the song that I referred to earlier, Never by the Sun, of which the payoff line for each verse is Scousers Never by the Sun. It's a reference to the boycott of the Sun newspaper by people in Liverpool after Hillsborough. Yeah. That line came to me while I was driving up to do this gig in Leeds, and I thought that is a really good line. There's a sort of a melodic kind of Scousers Never by the Sun. It goes around like that, you know. Scousers Never by the Sun. It's already in the line. So I just knew that I had to, when I got a chance to sit down with a guitar, I had to write something which the tagline was that.
So it's a song that started with the payoff line.
Yeah, it is, yeah. That was the point I wanted to make. I was trying to think who were the only people who come out with any moral dignity in the whole phone hacking scandal. Obviously, the journalists, the tabloids, it's shameful. The politicians who got involved with the Murdochs and their newspapers. And perhaps worst of all, those people who made the News of the World the biggest selling English language newspaper in the world.
Right.
All of us are a little complicit in that. But the idea that the people in Liverpool with their boycott were the only people who had some moral high ground, that gave me the punchline for the song. And I was able to come back out of that and build up to that. So I knew.
So you're almost working your way backwards.
And, well, you know,
and,
you're
and then you start again.
Yeah, you're painting pictures in that song. You know,
on, give us a sense of how it then panned out.
Someone's hiding in the bushes with a telephoto lens while their editor assures them the means justifies the ends. 'Cause we only hunt celebrities, it's just a bit of fun. But the Scousers never buy the Sun. The parents of the missing girl cling desperately to hope when a copper takes improper payments in a thick brown envelope. And no one in the newsroom asks where's this headline from. But the Scousers never buy the Sun. So the Liverpool people kind of become a ghost at the feast, looking down on everybody else. I'm running them through. I'm starting with the paparazzi. I'm bringing in the executives of News International. And then eventually, you who love that kiss and tell, you must bear some guilt as well. I'm spreading around the blame. But the people of Liverpool are the anchor for that song. I mean, not all songs are like that. I've had great tunes that I really liked, and I've written three or four different lyrics from them, and no, they're the wrong lyrics, thrown those lyrics away until the right lyric turned up.
And you throw them away or you keep them? Do they
stay
somewhere
in
the
notebook? Never throw anything away, do you? You put them in the woodshed, and another line, another time, you sort of drag it out and think to yourself, oh, yeah, no, that line just fits nicely in there.
We've time for one last question. This is from Imelda Michalczyk.
I wondered, what poetry would you discuss with today's taxman?
Well, yeah, I suppose my own sad poetry. You know, people talk to me about how I started out songwriting. I was one of those kids who wrote poetry at school, like we were all encouraged to do, but I didn't stop. Now, I don't know why the other kids stopped, but I just carried on trying to find a way to articulate what I thought. The line between, you know, poet and songwriter and performer is a very, very thin line. And to be able to, you know, couch my poetry in loud, raucous chords or gentle descending lines is something that underlines the power of music. I was talking earlier about young people engaging in politics through Twitter and through Facebook rather than through poetry and songwriting and doing gigs. And that's great, but the sad thing is As far as I know, nobody ever wrote a tweet that could make you cry. There is no festival of Facebook posts where you go to Canada and stand in front of an audience that you've never met before and wow them with your Facebook comments. You know, ultimately, if you do want to break the mould of who you are and what you're doing, using your poetry to do that, strapping on one of these things, stepping up these 18 inches higher than where you're sitting up here and doing that, it takes a lot of courage, but ultimately it kind of gives you a key to a whole different series of experiences that can only feed your poetry and feed your perspective. And that's what I look for in poetry. The poetry that I find myself most connecting with is that poetry that gives me a different perspective of the world.
Well, that's all we've got time for in this edition of the programme. Thanks for all your questions. Thanks for the audience here in the room. And thanks, most of all, to Billy Bragg for taking us back to talking with the Taxman about poetry.
Don't forget the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website. It'll have exclusive content, and you can download today's programme as well as the rest of the series there. You can also tweet us using hashtag BBC Master Tapes, all one word. Now we're going to leave you with another song from Billy. What are we going to go out with, Billy?
Well, I think we might take a brief sojourn into the warmest room. Rainy afternoon, spent in the warmest room. She lied before me and said, yes, it's true that I've seen some naked men.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.